pointing to a group of soldiers hunkered behind one of the larger rises. "Thanks," I said, and dashed in a crouch, plopping myself next to one of the soldiers lying in the center. Crashing to the ground in a rather less than graceful manner, I looked at the soldier lying next to me. Blue eyes, with a shock of blonde hair peeking out from the helmet, met my look. "I'm looking for Sergeant Connell," I said.
"You found her,"
she replied. "Well, Jack Walker," I extended my hand as best I could, lying pressed into the dirt. She returned the shake lightly and quickly. "What's the situation, Sergeant?" I asked.
"Well, we're pinned down on three sides by at least company strength. There's some blocking our route out to the east. The fire's been increasing, so I think they're being reinforced,"
she answers. "Casualties?" I asked.
"Three indigenous KIA with seven wounded. Two soldiers wounded, but mobile," she replied.
"Anyone unable to move? I mean, besides the KIA," I asked, apparently full of questions.
"Four."
"Fuck, that'll make it harder. What freak are you on? We tried calling," I said.
The radios are out. Both of them have taken hits. And who are you again?"
she asked.
"Any idea when our support is showing up?"
"You're looking at it," I replied.
"What? Just you?"
she asked with a measure of shock recording on her face.
"I'm all you need," I answered, chuckling.
"Okay, way kidding. I have a team to the east just in the tree line. We took out the blocking force there."
"So how is it you're here?"
she asked.
"Don't get me wrong, we could use the firepower, but I was expecting a little more."
"We were in the area and heard there was a party here," I answered.
"Aren't you the funny one? Seriously, they only sent you guys?"
"Well, apparently you pissed someone off at some point, so they sent us," I replied, not able to help myself. Her blue eyes and face, although covered in sweat and dirt, were quite attractive, but the sound of the rounds buzzing overhead kept my thoughts in line. A line stitched its way across the top of the rise, pelting us with dirt clods and dust. I pressed myself into the dirt, trying to actually get my back flush with the ground.
"Viper 6, Viper 5!
I barely heard the ATL say over the radio. "Viper 5, go ahead," I answered as the shower of dirt ended. I was thankful there weren't mortars at this point, or the only thing left of us would be picked up and put in buckets.
"We have visitors coming up the east side from the south. Platoon strength,"
Viper 5 said. "Roger that. Pull back and set up behind them. On my way shortly. Viper 6 out," I responded. "Well, crap. There goes our way out," I said.
"What do you mean?"
she asked. "Tango's in platoon strength coming up on the east side from the south," I answered. Sergeant Connell turned and yelled,
"Corporal Hedges, we have unfriendly company coming on the east side from the south. Keep their heads down." What unit did you say you were from?"
she turned back to me. The soldiers around us were sending semi-automatic fire out to the tree lines on all sides.
"Yeah, let's cover that some other time, shall we?" I answered.
I looked around as best I could while being pressed down. The circle of troops was closest to the north tree line, so I thought that may be our best way out. "Okay, our goal is to get to a landing zone a few clicks to the north," I say, showing her on the map. "I'll leave you my radio and head back. We'll circle around to the north and clear a hole for you. Try to get the wounded that aren't mobile onto stretchers. The cheek beating will have to be intense and we'll have to move fast. We have helicopter assets on standby, but for some stupid reason, they can't assist with keeping our backsides clear."
"Okay, the wounded are already on ponchos. We're getting low on ammo, so it'll have to be soon. I've already given the order to conserve, but we'll lay down cover fire for your dash out of here,"
she said.
"Viper 5, 6 here," I said into the radio.
"Go ahead, 6,
my ATL responded.
"What's the situation there?"
"Tangos are moving to the tree line and infiltrating north. It looks like they'll link up with the north line soon."
"Any place still clear? I'm on my way out."
"It looks like the northeast corner is still clear if you hurry,"
he answered.
"Okay, I'm leaving my radio here and on my way. Don't fire and meet me 25 meters inside the tree line," I told him.
"Copy that. Viper 5 out."
I took off my radio and handed it over.
"See you on the other side," I said.
"Cover fire!"
Sergeant Connell shouted. The intensity from our side picked up considerably, and the return firepower diminished to a degree. I rose and started running in a crouch toward the northeast. I just as suddenly stopped with my boots almost skidding across the torn-up field. Returning, I plop back down next to a rather startled Sergeant Connell.
Mr. Walker, or whatever you are, the woods are that way, I believe,
she said, pointing in the direction I was headed. Yeah, I came back to ask for your number and see if I could treat you to dinner sometime, I said, even surprising myself.
You're kidding, right?
She responded with an incredulous look on her face. No, I'm quite serious.
If I give you my number, will you then get the fuck out of here?
Yep. She gave me her number, right then and there. I reached down, pulled my knife from its sheath attached to my lower leg, and scratched her number into the crane stock of my M4. And your name? I mean, besides Sergeant Connell, I asked, hesitating with the point of my blade against the molded plastic.
Lynn, now get the fuck out of here, she said, shaking her head.
The sound of the firing was intense. Yells from the soldiers nearby added to the fields filled with sound. Green and red tracers streaked across the battlefield. I began my run once again. Bullets impacted the ground at my feet, and I heard the occasional zip as others passed close by my head. I concentrated only on the run and the trees to my front. It seemed like there was no way my body could fit in the open field without coming into contact with the steel filling the air. But I made it and plunged deeper into the dense undergrowth of the jungle to be greeted by a boonie hat rising above a large patch of fronds. We made our way around to a position behind enemy soldiers inside the tree line to the north. We found one end of the line and, with ourselves on line, began to systematically roll them up from behind. Our suppressors weren't heard, and they had no idea we were there. We stayed back in the jungle until we cleared most of the north line. It wouldn't be long before they realized that the north end wasn't firing, so we didn't have the luxury of time to roll them up entirely. Atlas 21, Viper, over, I said, taking our spare radio.
Viper, Atlas 21, go ahead,
Lynn responded. The firing through my earpiece when she had her mic open was loud in the background. It mixed with the firing we were hearing, but slightly out of sequence. The way is clear. Move your folks. We'll cover the flanks and fold up behind you. Head north to the LZ, I said.
We're on the way. Atlas 21 out.
They made their way across the field through our flanking line. We folded up behind the fast-moving soldiers. Enemy soldiers ran across the field in pursuit, and we heard others crashing through the jungle to either side. Setting short-time fuses and claymores, we put these to the side and rear to slow any advance and make them think twice about running after us. We then took off on the tail of Atlas 21. Bullets smacked into the trees around us as fire continued to be directed our way. Five loud, ground-shaking explosions filled the air behind us. The rounds that followed us tailed off. We planted our remaining claymores, with both time fuses and tripwires, in our path and off to the side of it as we made our way north. Several explosions later, all fire in our direction ceased. I notified Eagle that we were inbound to the LZ. Lynn radioed that they had made it to the LZ. We were 10 minutes behind with our pickup 15 minutes out. In short order, we were all picked up and airborne. The adrenaline and exhaustion of the day swept over me. At that time, a cold beer sounded like the best thing in the world. I looked down at the number and name etched into the stock of my M4 and smiled. Looking out of the open door to my right, I saw another Black Hawk in formation. In the open doorway sat Lynn, her helmet off and her short blonde hair hanging limply. She was staring at the steel floor and looked up. I gave her a head nod, which she returned and smiled. And the slamming of a hatch on one of the Humvees is startling. Yeah, good times, I say, as we both snap out of our remembering at the same moment.
It was certainly interesting,
she replies. Whispers of the Mind. The sound of hatches being closed echoes across the silent lot, signaling it's time to go. I love you, Lynn, I say, leaning over to give her a kiss.
I love you too, Jack, she says.
With a final squeeze of her hand, We separate, and I make my way to the Humvees and awaiting teams. "Make sure to keep intervals and the guns manned," I say, with the chill of the morning seeping through my fatigues. The others give tired nods, and we pile into the waiting vehicles. A gust of wind gives my pant legs a final shake before I climb into the passenger seat. The closing of the doors and engines starting ends the tranquil feel of the morning. Through a gap in the overhead clouds, the sun gives its first peak above the range of mountains, turning the blue of the pre-dawn into a dull orange glow. With a final look to Lynn standing in the shadows of the building, we start off. I give a wave, to which she replies in kind. I watch her get smaller in the side-view mirror until she disappears as we pass over the rise of the entrance road. A tear trickles down her cheek as she watches the vehicle's motor up the entrance and vanish behind the hill. This wasn't the homecoming she envisioned at all. Lynn had pictured coming home to Jack and settling into a routine of them and that of a stateside base. "Instead, we have this," she thinks, looking around the parking lot bathed in morning light. Silence once again returns. Her thoughts go back momentarily to their meeting, bringing a small smile to her worried face. "He has skills in the field, but he can be such a dork sometimes," she thinks lovingly. "I just wish he didn't think he had to do everything himself, or push himself, or think that he's the one making a mistake when things go wrong. He's pushing himself too hard. He plays at not being tired, but I know he's about to fall down from exhaustion and worry," Lynn says to herself, looking to where the vehicles disappeared moments ago. The rustle of the remaining teams, emerging from the interior behind, brings her back to the here and now. She whispers a final, "Stay safe, Jack." "Form up," she turns and yells, wiping away any sign of tears. The drive north is a quick and uneventful one. We pull onto the base and bypass the guard shacks. I think back to when we entered here for the first time, seemingly an eon ago. My stomach flips for a moment when I think back to the discovery there. The pant legs of the guard still project outward from one of the shacks. The terror and fear that must have filled those final moments, trying to fend off the horde with ammo running low, and the knowledge that it wasn't going to be enough. Fighting in the dark, surrounded by shrieks, and perhaps not knowing what was happening, only that someone or something was attacking, and your time was limited. Watching your comrades fall as they ran out of ammo. The finality of being surrounded and pulled to the ground when your own ammo was depleted. Those final moments must have a lingering effect on this place, to pull those images into my mind. "Yeah, that must have really sucked," I think, as we proceed past. We drive through the empty base that still has a ghost town look. The tall grass of the once perfectly manicured lawns in front of the buildings adds to the effect. The dark windows still look outward, giving both a melancholic and menacing feel. I cast my mind outward and have a faint sense of night runners housed within some of the buildings. I feel some of them stir, as if sensing my probe. I quickly shut my thoughts to the back of my mind, and the feeling of them disappears. I'm not used to this at all, and it gives me the creeps. I don't understand it, and am definitely not about to mention it until I do. The menace of the windows staring back as we pass becomes more and less frightening. More so because I know for a fact that night runners are housed within, and less so because of that knowing. Some fear is based on the unknown. Some of the menacing aspect the windows project is in the not knowing what is behind them. Knowing diminishes some of that, but brings another scary aspect, knowing for sure that they are there. The tips of the aircraft show behind hangars as we drive closer to the ramp. I look in my side mirror and note the guns on top of the Humvees behind swiveling to the buildings as we pass. Apparently they feel the same menace, or are just being cautious. I notice some of the tall grass trampled down in front of the buildings where I sensed night runners. I take note. That'll be another indication that night runners are housed within, and I put a marker in my mind to mention it. If we didn't have so much pavement on the earth, we'd be able to ascertain more by the paths the night runners create over time. However, I don't plan for them to be in our neighborhood for much longer, so the thought is kind of moot anyway. We pull onto the ramp and park behind the C-130 that's going to be our sanctuary for the next few days. The tired feeling is mixed with anticipation. I'm also feeling a little nervous. The high clouds indicate a change in the weather coming, or that we'll have en route. It's not that I'm worried about flying in the clouds per se, but I want to keep an eye on the ground to back up our inertial navigation. I'm sure I'll feel more comfortable once I can verify its accuracy. Well, I know it's accurate, but I'm the type that likes to have the verification, especially without other navigation gear as a backup. Plus, it's not the best season for venturing to the southwest. My mind is still on the potential for thunderstorms. The team members begin offloading gear from the Humvees and placing it on the ramp. We'll load it up once we get the two vehicles we're taking loaded and strapped down. Robert, Bree, Craig, and I head up into the cockpit with the flight planning materials and gear. Setting our gear on the bunk and helmets in the seats, Bree turns on the power so we can start loading our route into the flight computer. Robert steps away from his seat to allow access to the flight computer console. Shaking my head, I say, "You load it in." Robert sits and begins loading the data in, pausing every so often as he tries to remember the various screens and where to input the information. I watch over his shoulder because, well, after all, I'll be flying in the same aircraft, and I'm not all that keen on wandering all over the globe in search of the Southwest Desert. Craig crowds in to watch as I give him a heads up as to what Robert's doing. With the flight plan inputted, we head to the back to load the two Humvees we'll be taking into the aircraft and chain them down. It's not the most graceful of maneuvers, but we manage to get them both in reasonably straight and secured. We load the gear complete with crates of ammo, food, and water. There isn't much room left inside when we finish. Red, Echo, and Blue teams settle in where they can, with most folding down and taking the outside red nylon seats. Gonzalez and McCafferty follow Robert, Craig, Bree, and me up the steps into the cockpit. Robert moves over to the right seat to take his usual place as co-pilot and buckles in. I tap him on the shoulder. "What?" Robert turns around. I merely point to the left seat, but he only gives me a look of confusion. "You're sitting in the wrong seat," I say. Robert continues to look confused, but it changes to a startled look as he recognizes what I'm saying. I want him to fly as the pilot in command. I direct Craig into the co-pilot seat. I want to give Robert some confidence and for them to work together as they'll be flying this one back in a short time. It's not the most desirable solution, but it's the only one we have. I'll leave Bree with them and take both Gonzalez and McCafferty with me. It'll be busier in our aircraft, but it'll be manageable. I look over to the nav station where Nick sat, or at least the seat she sat at in the HC-130, and feel a deep pang of missing her. It seems like she should be with us, sitting in her usual place. A tremendous sadness comes over me thinking of my precious daughter. I miss the sound of her laughter and her smile that brightened my life every time I saw it. Her dark hair and hazel eyes. I really miss her. Tears well up in my eyes from wanting my sweet girl back. "I love you and miss you so much, Nick," I say quietly before turning back to where Robert, Craig, and Bree are conducting their startup checks. While not as fast as in previous flights, the checks are accomplished and we taxi out. I'm standing just behind Robert and next to Bree in her flight engineer seat. Robert runs the throttles up and we're soon in the air. The cleanup checks proceed smoothly, but I can tell Robert is nervous about being in command. His instructions sometimes sound like questions, but he's doing a great job. I can kind of understand that, though. He is a teenager giving commands to a grown man about flying a large four-engine aircraft. Bree is performing her checks and operating the systems perfectly. I am so proud of them.
Michael lies asleep in his lair after a successful night of hunting, dreaming deeply of the chase. The lair seems empty after being inhabited only a short time ago by other members of his pack. He continues to assimilate his new memories with the old. His relative awareness grows. He hunts alone at night and shuts himself out from the others, the awareness of them placed to the side but still with a vague perception of them. He sits, bolt upright, instantly alert. Something brought him out of his dream. He looks around the darkened room that has grown chillier with each coming day. He sees everything in the room, despite the inky black of the interior. Something different brushes his mind. He senses more than feels a vibrating and rumbling noise outside. But what catches his attention is the faint whisper in his head. It's different than the feel and touch of the others of his kind. A second later, he knows it's one of the two-legged. He feels a sense as strong as his, different yet strong. It was just a light brush, but enough for him to become aware of it. He feels confused and intrigued. However, a sense of worry also surfaces. Michael finds it strange that he can sense one of the two-legged, even if just for a moment. He waits for another sensing, but nothing appears. The vibration and rumbling fade into the distance. Tiredness from the night's hunt takes hold once again. He lies on the carpeted floor and falls back to sleep. Rising with the setting of the sun, he stretches in the dark and readies himself for another night of hunting. Eagerness spills into his eyes. He lives for the hunt and the thrill of the chase. With that feeling inside, he ventures out like he does every night and tests the air for scents. The night has more moisture than those previous. This is good news, as the moist air will carry the scent of prey better. He lifts his nostrils to the cloudy night sky. The remembrance of the touch on his mind surfaces, and he glances quickly to his left toward the large two-legged lair. He stands for a moment, and although he is eager to be off on the hunt, he knows it will have to wait. The intrigue of that brush speaks louder than his desire for the chase. With a move so quick that it would startle most humans, one minute standing still and the next moving, he lopes toward the lair he has avoided so far. He keeps his presence and ability to sense others in the back of his mind, yet keeps alert as he draws closer to the tall walls. He expects the feeling of the two-legged one he felt to return as he nears. The ability is limited by distance. Not knowing why he sensed a two-legged one, he thinks the distance may limit it even more. He senses nothing as he draws cautiously to the walls. The smell of the two-legged prey behind the walls increases. Their scent is strong in the air, especially seeing that they have been there for a considerable length of time. He looks to the walls. He can't see any way to scale their heights. He doesn't hear any of the two-legged ones and throws caution to the wind as he takes a running leap in an attempt to reach the top, but falls several feet short. He looks down the wall's length, stretching past his vision, seeing no change in the height. Michael backs up further and tries again, but with the same result. Looking carefully for any handholds he missed on first glance, he sees nothing he can use. He looks to the ground and begins to dig where the wall meets the tall grass. He manages to get a foot down, but has to stop as the soil becomes too hard. The wall follows his path downward. There's no way under. Feeling frustration at not being able to sense whatever brushed his mind during his sleep, nor gain entrance, he lopes along the wall looking for any change. He
He circumnavigates the entire boundary without finding any. Picking up the ascent of additional prey behind the seemingly insurmountable walls, his frustration increases. The trip around has taken a large part of his time for hunting. The smell of prey is tantalizingly close, but he can't get to it. He knows he must be off if he is to feed tonight. With a shriek of frustration and rage, he lopes into the night to use the last few hours to find food. The sun vanishes behind the upper layer of clouds as we begin our climb. I ask Robert to keep us down low and give our sanctuary a low pass. Kind of a farewell, if you will. He levels off and descends slightly, turning farther to the south, picks up I-5, and follows it. We're only around 500 feet above the ground. Not too low, but not terribly high either. The changing weather brings the occasionally choppy turbulence, but Robert handles it fine. The walls of the sanctuary come into view, and we head directly for the green roof of Cabela's. Well, not directly at it, as that would entail smacking into it. That's not the optimal idea. Any move in that direction would most definitely garner my undivided attention. We more fly towards it. As we approach the tall gray walls surrounding the compound, I feel a sudden intrusion into my mind. It's not like the other night runners I felt. This one is, well, it's hard to describe, but I would say there's a greater strength to it, and, as odd as it sounds, it's more aware. It's just a feeling, and I only feel it for a moment. As fast as it came, it's gone. I look immediately out of the left window where the feeling emanated. Several large stores and strip malls are across the highway from Cabela's, but I pinpoint exactly where the sensation came from. There's a Safeway store nestled in a large strip mall a little ways away. That's the same Safeway where I had that strange vision, I think, wondering exactly what it was, or is, that I felt. It felt like a night runner, but not exactly. I store the episode in the back of my mind. Part of me wants to cast forth to see what it was, to see if I can sense it again. But something holds me back. Perhaps I don't want to know. We fly over the walls in the parking lot, slide underneath. Robert gives a rock of the wings, puts the power up, and begins to climb into the morning sky. I give a last look at the Safeway as it slides past our wing. I store the presence I felt in the back of my mind to ponder over later. We have a flight to make. An answer is found. We continue our climb with the high clouds drawing closer the higher we go. I notice the images and sense of the night runners, which I've placed in their own mental compartment, dissipate and vanish altogether as we gain altitude and distance. Mount Rainier slides by our wing, and we fly above the brown fields of central and eastern Washington. The Columbia River comes into view soon. We draw even closer to the clouds, and it's apparent we won't be able to reach our planned altitude of flight level 200, 20,000 feet. Robert, level off here, I say as we approach 17,000 feet. I want to keep a visual reference with the ground. Okay, Dad, he says into the intercom. I plugged into the navigator station with the longer crew chief cord so I can walk around and be close to Robert just in case. He's handled himself well, but if something happens, I want to be close. He levels off and powers back to a normal cruise flight setting. I get Bree's attention and nod to McCafferty. She gets my meaning and slides out of her seat, allowing McCafferty to take over the flight engineer duties. We begin broadcasting on both the VHF and UHF emergency frequencies and plan to do so every half hour. The clouds vanish as we head across the northeastern part of Oregon, and Robert climbs to our originally planned altitude. The forested hills of the Blue Mountains slide quickly past, and before long, we see Boise off our nose. I check the inertial nav with ground references. It's right on, which alleviates that stress to a certain extent. The sky is clear, as the city slides just off the left side. There isn't a smoke line drifting skyward from the city. Although we're at altitude, there doesn't appear to be any movement either. The crisscross pattern of streets lies empty. There is one exception. A mess of rubble lies close to the center of town, blocking the streets. We pass over the empty city knowing that when night comes, the streets will be full of activity. It's as if the city is holding its breath during the day and is itself fearful of the night setting. All cities seem to have this aspect. The age of mankind as we knew it is just a memory, held in the walls and streets of mankind's structure. Mountain Home tells pretty much the same story. A few spirals of smoke from still smoldering fires drift lazily above the base located there. There's more rubble in the parking lot where it looks like the BX or some other large building is. Military aircraft of all types sit on the silent ramps. Each town we fly over gives off a feeling of loneliness. But perhaps that's simply us missing the world we once knew. Not much is said as we pass over the brown plains of Idaho. I notice a movement from McCaffrey next to me as she reaches up to switch tanks. My heart almost stops in my chest as I realize what she's doing, and in the moments my hand races towards hers, I'm hoping I will be in time. Both of her hands are reaching for the fuel switch panel, one on each side. She's attempting to switch the tanks on both sides at once. That's not the issue, though. She's about to do it in the wrong sequence. I'm not sure why I looked, but I'm grateful I did. I manage to grab her hand before she turns the switch closest to me and hope it will stop her from switching the other. As my hand grabs hers, she stops all movement. Or perhaps it was me yelling, "No!" in the intercom. All eyes turn quickly to me, startled as if expecting the plane to come apart at any moment. You have to switch the pumps on, open the valves on the tank you're switching to first, and then close the valve to the tank you're feeding from, I say, after my heart starts beating again with a mighty pound in my chest. If you do it the other way, there will be no fuel flowing to the engines, and that's a less than optimal situation. Plus, do one side at a time.
Okay, sir. Sorry,
McCafferty says, and proceeds to do it in the correct sequence. Bree looks from me to the panel and back with a look of chagrin on her face.
I'm sorry, Dad. I should have been watching,
Bree says. No worries. No harm, no foul, I respond. But keep a watch next time. I'm not all that interested in exploring the glide characteristics of this beast.
I will, Dad,
Bree says. I nod, both as acknowledgement and assurance that all is good. We weren't far from getting a closer look at the streets of Twin Falls. We would have been able to restart the engines without too much difficulty, but having all of your engines quit has to rank up there with having your head sewn to a carpet. It's just the idea of flying along without the propellers turning for that length of time that raises the pucker factor by a degree or two. However, we didn't, so it's easily forgotten. Well, maybe not, as I know that my eyes will now track to the panel each time we switch tanks. I cover various emergencies with Robert and Craig. The mountains of the Continental Divide enter our field of view, along with Salt Lake City a short time later. Small plumes of smoke are still rising from the city, but they're brownish in nature, indicating yet more smoldering fires. There aren't many, and they aren't large. We pass the large city and enter the tan of the desert proper, after crossing over a small range of mountains. We're over halfway through the flight, and I begin to see the tops of building cumulus clouds to the southeast, directly in our line of flight.
Now that doesn't bode well,
I think, wrapping up another emergency procedure. McCaffrey makes way for Gonzalez at the flight engineer station. I point out the rising clouds in the distance, their tops and sides reflecting white from the sun. Lower down, they turn into an ugly, boiling mess of dark blue, gray, and black as more of the line of building thunderstorms becomes visible. Although I can't see his knuckles, I do notice Robert's grip on the steering column grow tighter.
"Are we going through those?"
he asks.
"Or around?"
"I'd rather not, and I don't think we'll be able to go around," I answer, watching the squall line build quickly to the northeast directly across our flight path. They look like they're sitting right over Clovis.
"What should we do then?"
he asks. "I don't know. You're the pilot in command. You tell me."
"We should divert then?"
he says. It comes out as both a statement and a question. "Whatever you say," I reply. "That would be my choice," Craig chimes in. I can tell he's holding off saying anything, letting Robert arrive at his own conclusion, and recognizing my wanting Robert to learn to take command. Robert holds up the map he has sitting on the console. He looks up and compares the map with what he sees outside. After a moment, he says,
"It looks like Kirtland AFB is still in the clear. We'll land there."
There was no question with that statement. I hold back a nod or statement of correctness. I want him to analyze and choose an action without having my acknowledgement. Own the decision and proceed with it, so that he can get used to making decisions and acting on them. He's gained a tremendous amount of confidence, as has Bree, and they will gain more. The turbulence begins to increase as we draw closer to the towering line of clouds. They're still in the distance, but their height is more than impressive. The thunderstorms in this area can reach 70,000 feet and beyond. If you haven't seen these kinds of storms, you should add that to your bucket list. The power inherent within the boiling mass of clouds is impressive. The air and land below are cloaked in dark shadows, with a light show streaking from the clouds to the ground. Craig gathers the maps and approach charts to Kirkland AFB as the all arms and elbows show that a divert causes begins. Robert sets up and begins a descent to the city of Albuquerque. There's a continuing flurry of activity within the cockpit, along with an increase in the bouncing of the aircraft. Robert looks at the map between checks to find the airport. I hold on to the back of his seat as the aircraft attempts to knock me off my feet at times. I can tell he's trying to locate the field with the way he's holding the map up in front of his face and looking outside. "Ah, there it is," I hear him say over the intercom. With that, he sets the map down.
"Craig, what runways are there?"
Robert asks.
"We have 0826, 1735, 0321, and 1230,
Craig answers, looking at the field diagram in the approach charts. I'm interested in finding out which one he chooses. The long line of storms lies a few miles away. I'm surprised to see them so big this early in the day, but it does happen. Usually, squall lines like the one in front of us form in the afternoons and evenings as the air from the heated ground rises and cools. The turbulence we're experiencing so far out shows an unstable air mass, so that must have contributed to the early rising storms. I'm hoping we'll be able to get down to Cannon AFB in the morning. I glance over and notice tension around Gonzalez's eyes. I'm not sure if it's the flying, being nervous operating the panel, or if it's because we're close to her home and family. Robert hesitates a moment, deciding which runway to use. We continue our descent.
"Which one's the longest one?"
he asks, pointing outside.
"The longest one is 0826.
Craig answers.
"Okay, we'll use that one. We'll use runway 08 as it's closer. I would use whichever one the wind dictates, but we don't have that information,"
Robert says, turning the aircraft to get into alignment with the runway. "That's a good choice," I say, deciding to interject my thoughts. "One, it's the longest, and the ground level around here is over 5,000 feet. You know what that means, right?"
"Longer ground roll and takeoff distances," he answers.
"Yep, exactly. Plus, with the storms nearby, there's the chance one of these storms can have a downburst. That means strong winds can head this way in a hurry from them. I'd rather be heading into something like that rather than away when landing," I add. I see the wheels turn quickly in his mind as he absorbs this information.
"Makes sense. We could stall out if it came behind us,"
he says, after a moment of contemplation. I'm glad to see him able to work through these thoughts while setting up for a landing as well. It gives me more confidence about our return flight. I give him a pat on the shoulder. You've got this handled. I glance at the overhead panel to make sure Gonzalez, under Bree's supervision, has set them up correctly. I still remember our near-glider experience. The gusty winds and turbulence make the final approach a tricky one, with the threshold of the runway bouncing around in front of the nose like a drunk trying to fit a key in a lock. But Robert manages to get us down. The turbulence continues into the flare. We rise and then set down a little abruptly, but we're able to walk away from it, so it's a good landing. We taxi into where a couple of HC-130s are parked and shut down. The wind continues to buffet the aircraft as strong gusts blow through the area. I'm not sure if the storms will venture this way during the day or evening, but their presence is certainly felt. We unbuckle and head into the back. There's the unmistakable odor of someone that didn't enjoy the turbulence much. The 130 is notorious for shaking, so I'm not surprised. I open the ramp and, after setting a schedule for the teams to guard the area, tell everyone they're free to loiter outside as long as they don't venture far or alone. We find a shop vac in one of the open hangars and clean up the mess inside. We even find some of the aromatic kitty litter used for such messes. I'm not sure which is worse, though, the original smell or the aromatic nature of the kitty litter. The gusts continue to sweep through the area, but other than the occasional deep rumble of the storms in the distance, no other sound is heard.
Surely there must be other survivors, I think, surveying the ramp. After all, we found others in our area. Perhaps they'll respond to the sound of our arrival.
Although it was a relatively short flight, we're all thankful to be outside regardless of the blustery conditions. It's warm and humid, but it's nice to be out of the aircraft. If the storms alter their direction and decide to pay us a visit, we'll be confined back in the 130 and all of its comforts. Read facetious. MREs are open, and we take as much protection from the gusts as the leeward side of the aircraft will allow. The thin air of the high desert is keenly felt. After being at sea level for so long, I feel like I can't catch my breath. The team on guard splits into teams of two, and they station themselves, with binoculars, around the ramp. They should be able to give us some warning of anything untoward. Sitting on the ramp, I notice just how gritty and covered with sand it is. The desert is slowly beginning to take back what was once its domain. I look across the ramp and notice a wide trail cut through the grit where we taxied in. It's not something that'll affect us greatly at this point, but definitely something to keep in mind. We'll have to conduct low passes at each field to verify their condition. I should have thought about that here, but my attention was focused on both Robert and the near thunderstorms. Even sheltered against the wind, the gusts continue to blow, bringing more sand with them. I even feel the grit of it in my mouth as I chew. "Are we going to fuel up here?" Robert asks, finishing his meal. "I think we should be okay. The storms look like they may be building in this direction, and I don't want to be in the midst of fueling if they do. They can move rather quickly when they want," I answer.
"Makes sense," he says.
"Sir, we have company,"
I hear Horace say over the radio. Blue team is currently on guard. The call gets everyone's attention, and we stand quickly with weapons in hand. Lunches half eaten fall to the ground. "What do you have, Horace?" I ask, looking around the area.
"Three people near the end of the runway to the west, two men and a woman, armed but not bringing them to bear in any overt fashion. They're just standing and looking our way,"
she reports. I look in the direction reported and contemplate getting the Humvees out for additional fire support and mobility. There are only three reported, but there could be others around. I don't see anything, but it is some distance away. I head into the aircraft to grab a pair of binoculars. "Keep an eye out for others," I radio the team as I grab the binoculars and head back outside. I direct the other team members to cover around the other HC-130s parked on the ramp. This is the only C-130 I see, and we'll need it to carry our Humvees. The move to different cover is to keep any rounds away from our transport in case gunfire is exchanged. Any change? I ask Horace as we settle into our new positions.
No, sir, they're just standing there watching us through a set of binoculars as well,
she replies. They can see you then?
I'm pretty sure they can, sir. At least they appear to be looking directly at us.
Okay, wave them in. Everyone stay alert and keep an eye on the entire perimeter. A moment passes and I glass the area indicated by Horace. Adjusting the focus, three people come into view. It appears one of the men and the woman have hunting rifles, with the other man carrying a shotgun. All have a sidearm strapped to their hip. I see them talk to one another and begin heading in our direction. They cautiously approach with their weapons ready, but not threatening. As they draw closer, I head over to Horace's position, reaching where she and Bartell are hunkered behind a concrete barrier along the edge of the ramp. I see the three have stopped about 100 yards away. I rise and begin walking toward them, telling everyone else to stay in position. With my approach, they continue nearing once again until we're standing about 20 yards from each other. The men appear to be in their late 20s and have the appearance, with their stance and short haircuts, of being either in the military when everything happened or at least having prior service. The woman appears to be middle-aged, with dark, curly hair cut to her shoulders. They're all a little disheveled, with streaks of dirt covering their faces and stains ground into their jeans and shirts. We mean no ill will, and as long as you have the same intentions, you're welcome to join us for lunch and conversation if you like, I call out. They look to each other. One of the men shrugs, and they all shoulder their rifles and close in. I shoulder mine as well, and have the team stay on the alert, but stand down. I'm Jack. I reach my hand out as we come together.
Thomas,
one of the men says, accepting my shake.
Jeremy,
the other says.
Laurel.
The woman has a hint of a Texas accent. We walk back to the group, which is reconvened in our sheltered spot on the lee side of the C-130. Our three newcomers are handed MREs, which they dig into. They share the story of their meeting during a day scrounging for food and water. Thomas, Jeremy, and Laurel have been holing up in one of the gyms of a high school nearby and ventured our way after hearing the aircraft arrive. They mention seeing a small number of others from time to time, but haven't made contact with them. They heard our 130 fly over and thought perhaps it was a remnant of a military group left over from the calamity. The supplies in the area were getting more difficult to gather with their small group, and it was only a matter of time before their place was finally overrun. So far, they had kept the beasts at bay during the night, but were worn out from having to do so. We're based in the Northwest. You're welcome to join us if you'd like, I mention. I give a synopsis of our story and a rundown of our situation. They look at each other and all shrug as if saying, why not?
If you don't mind, I think we'll take you up on that,
Thomas says. We share our stories. Sure enough, both Thomas and Jeremy were prior Army, while Laurel was prior Navy and was on her way to purchase a horse when everything went down. The early afternoon passes with the storm staying a short distance away. Their bases have become darker, if that were even possible, looking like bruises. The gusts of wind carry the distinct smell of ozone, giving me the indication that they could drift our way. Echo Team replaces Blue Team on watch. Soon after, the radio crackles to life once again.
Jack! Greg! We have additional company. They just emerged from behind a hangar over by the tower. I count 15, but could be one or two off. They spotted us at the same time and went to cover, Greg reports. They're currently by the tower with what appears to be automatic weapons pointed in our direction.
That again gets our attention, and we fan out, finding whatever cover we can find. I immediately glass the area by the control tower and see people with muzzles pointing in our direction. The ones I see are in uniforms, and judging from the barrels sticking out from their cover, they do appear to be armed, as Greg reported. There's about 200 yards separating us. No one makes a move in either direction. I'm still cautious from our marauder experiences. I'm not sure where their caution is coming from, but I certainly can't understand it. We have 3 teams here with 18 soldiers, and they have 15 or so. Depending on various factors, it can come out either way if steel starts being exchanged. We're definitely more in the open, but the parked 130s provide ample coverage. We don't have many flanking options as we have to traverse the open part of the ramp. We could if we laid down covering fire and gained the upper hand. However, we could easily find ourselves stuck here if their rounds find vital parts of the aircraft around us. At least, stuck as far as flying options go. The standoff continues. I try yelling to the other group, but my voice is carried away with the wind. At least I assume so, as I get no response back, either vocally or from any movement on their side. I decide that we're not going to get anything resolved in this manner. "I'm going out," I say over the radio. "If I go down, Red and Blue Team lay down a base of cover fire. Greg, you'll be in charge. I suggest you take Echo across the ramp under the cover fire and flank them from the hangars."
"Are you sure that's the best of ideas? To go out there? We could just do as you suggest," Greg replies back.
"No, I'm not sure, but I don't see where we have a choice. There's a good chance the aircraft will be disabled should we exchange fire," I answer.
"Okay, Jack. Best of luck to you," Greg says.
I look to Gonzalez and Horace crouched nearby. They both nod their reply. I hand my M4 to Gonzalez and rise. Keeping my hands in the air, I walk onto the open ramp separating the two groups. I see some activity from the ones behind cover, eventually observing an individual rise and walk in my direction. I take note that he isn't carrying a weapon. The ACU-clad soldier and I meet close to the middle of our two groups, with the wind whipping around us in gusts. The storms faintly rumble in the background. We drop our hands to our sides. "I'm Jack Walker," I open up the conversation.
"Sergeant Prescott,"
the younger man replies. He appears to be in his early 30s with his sandy brown hair cut tight against his tanned head. "We aren't looking for trouble, and if you're thinking the same, what do you say we stand down?"
"Are you part of a military unit?"
he asks as his reply. "Most of the folks with us were when all this went down. I'm prior Air Force." He nods. "Okay, I'm for standing down. We have some itchy trigger fingers behind me, as I'm sure you have as well," Prescott says, finally answering me. We both speak into our radios, telling our individual groups to stand down but stand by. "I take it you and your group are military?" I ask.
"And most of us," he replies. "We have a few civilians we've met up with as well."
"I don't suppose you have any pilots with you?"
"No, I wish we did. We have a variety, though. A couple of mechanics, medical orderlies, clerks, security personnel, and such. Most are Air Force like you. I was with base security," he answers.
"And we have about the same, except most are, or were, Army soldiers," I say, and give a rundown of our situation and the setup. We share stories. Prescott and his group have holed up in the tower for the past couple of months. They forage during the day and secure the tall concrete structure at night. The night runners tried desperately to get in at the beginning, but have mostly left them alone in the past couple of weeks. Water has become scarcer as the summer progresses, but they've been collecting rainwater as the storms venture over their area.
"Well, it might be a little crowded in the 130 at the moment, but you're welcome to join us if you feel so inclined," I say as our stories draw to a close.
"I'd have to talk it over with the others. We're pretty secure here, and the water situation will clarify itself,"
Prescott answers. "Okay, we're staying here tonight and leaving early in the morning. We can drop by here on our way back if you'd like to talk to the others about it.
We'd be happy to have you, but I get staying in a place you're familiar with and that feels secure, I respond.
That sounds good to me. It'll give us time to analyze our choices.
Just a warning, the night runners, as you call them, prowl around the base at night, Prescott says. And we should be pretty secure in the 130. We've spent many a night with the pounding and shrieking outside. It's not the best situation sleep-wise, but I doubt they can get in unless they figured out how to manipulate intricate doors. If we don't talk to you before we leave, we'll see you in a few days, weather permitting.
Sounds good, Jack. Good luck to you. By the way, what'd you do in the military?
He asks. I give him a brief synopsis of my military career. I note concern creep into his eyes as I talk.
I guess that should be a sir, then, he says as I finish.
Nah, Jack works. See you in a few days. With that, we turn and head back to our respective groups. Prescott rejoins his group, and they head into the tower. I let our teams know it's all good, and we break out of our cover. The wind whips a little stronger, bringing a sharp chill. The first large drops of rain begin to fall as the storms expand and head our way. We gather in the aircraft and button it up. The flashes of lightning and subsequent rumbles grow closer and louder. The angry-looking clouds swallow up the sun, and the day grows dark. I have Robert start the 130 and taxi us closer to the hangar. I don't think New Mexico has a lot of tornadoes, but my experience in Texas with these storms makes me a little cautious. If we do spot one, we'll dart into the hangar. If one does come at night, like I've seen them do on occasion, well, I just hope it doesn't sweep over us. If that happens, we're pretty screwed. It will, however, keep the ramp clear of night runners. The interior is lit up at close intervals as the storm draws overhead. The brilliant flashes of intense white light fill the inside. The cracks of thunder follow at close intervals, with their sound fading off in rumbles. The sky opens up, and heavy rain beats against the skin of the aircraft. The din inside makes it hard to hear anything else. We just settle in where we can and wait it out. With the storms hammering outside and turning day into night, it's hard to actually tell when night comes. The only way I know, besides it actually getting darker outside, is the stirring of pictures and voices in my head. I pack them down to where they're a remote and almost ignorable buzz. However, the increased signals denote the time of the night runners is about to begin. I'm not sure how the storms will affect their normal activity, but I'm interested in finding out. I don't feel them moving about a whole lot, as I can only sense the ones close. The range of sensing becomes limited the more I keep the ability in the back of my head. I notice that the fact that I can sense and understand the night runners is settling within me. It still seems weird, but it is transforming to become normal. I now know that the picture voices in my head are real, and I am also equally sure it must have been some change that came about from being scratched. Some of the Night Runner blood must have run across the opening in my skin. I also feel fear inside because I wonder if the changing is finished. I'm not at all interested in transforming into one of them. That would totally suck. I don't feel any more headaches or changes, so I'm hoping that whatever happened has run its course. The storms dissipate or move on as the night progresses. With the departure of the wind, light, and noise, the night runners emerge. It's not long before the last of the thunder rumbles away and is replaced by several night runners slamming against the sides of the aircraft. Their all too familiar shrieks echo through the thin fuselage. It brings back reminders of our first few days. It's not a complacent feeling, as being encircled by the ferocious night runners is never comfortable. All it takes is one opening, and they'll be all over us. I move into the cockpit to get a look outside. It's quite apparent we're not going to get any sleep, so I wearily climb the steps. The sky has cleared, and the stars glow bright in the night sky, with no other light to interfere. I see the night runners clearly as they are gathered around taking runs at the aircraft. Some are trying to leap onto the trailing edge of the wings, but fall way short. I open my mind a touch to them and see the picture images. There seem to be leaders among them giving directions, directing other night runners to different places and to try different approaches. This all comes in pictures rather than words, but I find myself understanding their meaning. With me opening up, I notice one off to the side by the outboard engine on the left. He's staring intently at me. I try to focus in on individual images and sense a confusion radiating from him. It's as if he's trying to understand something new. The images and language are very primitive, but I do get the gist. In my tired state, with my mind seeming to float from one idea to another, the thought comes, wondering if I can project like they can. Stop! I project the appropriate image forth, trying to cast it over a wide area. Every night runner halts in their tracks and turns their heads abruptly to stare directly at me. At least the ones I see do. I sense the one I think of as the leader startle. The images from the leader resume, and the night runners continue their attempts at entry. Interesting, I think. I said, stop, or I'll kill all of you, I project. The images I send out to portray this thought cannot be adequately described. Again, they all stop and look upward. I sense a great deal of frustration from the leader. Perhaps it's because someone is interfering with his instructions, or it could just be the frustration of not being able to get inside. I'm not able to actually read their minds, just hear them talking and sense where they are if I open up. He sends them back at it with renewed fury. Okay, that didn't work out very well, I say quietly to myself, but put the fact that they can hear me in my bag of tricks. I note that other night runners show up at intervals, and the ones already there venture off after a while. The howls are relentless, as are the sounds of night runners pounding against the aircraft. It makes for a sleepless night. Frustration and anger build inside me at not being able to rest. It escalates to the point where I'd almost open the door just to get it over with if it would make them stop. I'd totally forgotten how awful it is to be under this shrieking assault all night. I think it was the terror and newness of it that allowed us to tolerate it before. Now that we have a safe place, it allows us to know what a semblance of peace is like, and the constant pounding and shrieking is nerve-wracking. If it wouldn't damage the aircraft, I'd throw a grenade out the side cockpit window and see how they liked that. With that thought, I head back down into the cargo compartment. I have the team members stick gauze from the med kits in their ears, and I settle into my bag to try and rest as well as I can. It's not easy, but I manage to get some restless sleep. The sudden cessation of noise outside brings me instantly awake. I rise and enter the cockpit. The sky is lighter, and I feel the night runners fade into the distance. I wonder if they can sense me. I'm guessing so by the way they looked right at me when I deliberately projected outward. I wonder if they can sense me when I shove them into the back of my mind, or whether it's an all-of-the-time thing. I'll have to find out before going into a building with a team. While being able to sense the night runners if I open up is a good thing, having them able to pinpoint me is not. I should have experimented with that last night. Gonzalez sits listening to the night runners outside. Their shrieks and howls have replaced the familiar sound of the thunderstorms. The thunder and flashes of light from the storms
bring back memories of years past, both good and bad. Her mind ventures the scant 200 miles east to her hometown. She was always close to her family, but growing up in the streets on the south side of town had been rough. It wasn't a large town, but the gangs that ran the streets made life difficult, especially being a girl.
"Well, that's not entirely true,"
she thinks, remembering the brother she lost to the gangs. She really didn't know him, but he came around from time to time and then vanished into the streets again. There came a time when he quit showing up. Gonzalez never knew if he lived or left this world the way most gang members leave. Young. Growing up on those hot streets was hard and forced her to become tough in order to endure. The poor neighborhood she grew up in made the warm days seem hotter. Her father was very protective of her and her sister and shielded them as best as he could. The trains rolling through the switching yards just to the south were constant sounds, as were the occasional gunshots at night. She left to join the army to escape and to prove herself. Her father's protective nature, although probably called for given the environment, didn't allow her to be herself. She came back to visit during her leaves and enjoyed seeing her family, but the neighborhood was oppressive, and she was just as happy when she left. She envisioned a day when she could afford to bring her parents and sister out of there and live in a better place. Gonzalez holds on to that dream, although for much different reasons than before. The slams against the aircraft continue. The flight down brought both apprehension and exhilaration. She hopes to find them alive and bring them to the safety they've created. The dread she carries is what she might find, them dead or worse. However, with Jack finding out that the immunity trait might be familial, there is the hope that they are still alive. Even if the night runners weren't keeping her awake, she doubts she'd be able to sleep. Tomorrow will bring an answer, one way or the other, to the fate of her family. She's not sure she actually wants to know the answer. On the other hand, she knows she needs to.
The cargo compartment stirs with those rising. We stow our gear and prepare for the quick hop to the east. Cannon AFB is only about 200 miles away, so we should be able to land and head off to find Gonzalez's family in short time. I hope we find them in good shape. I do a quick walk around to make sure the night runners didn't jar anything loose that might interfere with our attempt at flight. The sky is mostly clear, but there are a few clouds that materialize with the rising of the sun. They're building ever so slightly and hold the promise of more storms. If we're going to get there, it's time we were off. There's no sign of the group we met yesterday, and the tower remains silent. Robert, Craig, and Bree ready themselves. We taxi out and take off with the sun just above the horizon. The flight is a short but bumpy one. Robert finds the airfield to the west of Clovis and sets us up for an approach after a low flyby. The town and base are surrounded by endless brown fields. The faint remnants of circular crops, created from sprinkler systems revolving around a central axis, remain. But the lack of water has quickly dried these out, the fields all becoming the same color. The clouds, which were only small buildups when we took off, continue climbing to the point that they are white, billowing clouds by the time we arrive. The airfield seems clear and without movement. That's not surprising, as our radio calls have so far gone unanswered. Looking to the ramp on our flyby, I spot 10 C-130s parked in clumps along its length. Over half of them are AC-130s, which makes the little boy inside of me smile.